Welcome to the Lesbian Book Club with Claire Lydon. Please enjoy the podcast from My Lesbian Radio.
Hello and welcome to episode 8 of the Lesbian Book Club with me, your host, Claire Lydon. On this edition, we are going to be speaking to Wisconsin-based author Eliza Lenski, and you'll hear the fabulous chat we had very shortly. But before we get to that, we're going to see what's hot in the UK and US Amazon lesbian fiction charts, as well as an update about my upcoming release and other news. First up, the Amazon charts. On Monday, June the 1st, as I read this, a book called The Woman Upstairs by Cameron Eade is sitting pretty at the top of the UK lesbian romance charts. And frankly, why wouldn't it be, seeing as the cover has an image of a woman in a tool belt, which is surely every lesbian's dream date. The woman, though, for me, is wearing jeans with just too big a flare for my taste. But then, you know, I'm told the flare is coming back, and before you know it, it's going to be the 90s all over again. And we're all going to be dancing to the Backstreet Boys, and take that. So you've been warned. Also still up there is J.A. Armstrong's design series, and the ever-popular Radcliffe is in at number 4 with her political yarn, The Price of Honour, which I'm sure is a great book because I've read quite a few Radcliffes, and they're always solid reads. In the USA, The Woman Upstairs and J.A. Armstrong series are also doing well in the charts, along with Tracy Richardson's well-received new tome, The Song in My Heart, which has a guitar on the front, which, as we all know, a guitar and a lady, those two things go together. And that one's getting a lot of positive praise all over the internet. Alexandra Delancey's Always Her is still up there, and that's been bothering the top 5 for quite a few weeks now, so well done to Alexandra on her debut. And the woman I'll be chatting to in a moment, Eliza Lenski, is at number 10 with her third book in the Winter Jacket series. And now we're into June. I can't believe we're already into June. And since the last book club, my third book, This London Love, has gone to my editor and is currently being told off by Red Pen and my editor looking stern. But that's all good. My cover's also sorted, so we're, you know, coming into the home straight of the production process. Fingers crossed. Last week I showed off my shiny new cover for the first time, as well as revealing the first 2 chapters of my book online, and I got some really nice positive feedback on the cover and the chapters, so that's great. You can go to my blog to read the first 2 chapters if you want to find out more. That's clairelydon.co.uk. Or stay listening. At the end of this podcast, I'm going to be reading out the first 2 chapters in a whole new section of this Lesbian Book Club podcast. Yikes! Yikes, I hear you cry. Other things I'm involved with is, remember this year I'm hosting the Indie Author Panel at Elfest with the fantastic Karen Campbell, H.P. Monroe, Suzanne Egerton and Sally Edwards. So if you fancy hearing us chat about our writing and hearing us read from our novels, buy your tickets for Elfest now and come along on the Saturday lunchtime. And even if, you know, you don't want to come and hear us read, why wouldn't you though? I don't know. Come to Elfest anyway, because it's great fun. It's tons of fun in a field with lesbians as far as the eye can see. And there's dancing, and there's beer, and last year there was also a really good stall that made fish finger sandwiches. So I can't see a reason not to come. Elfest takes place the 3rd weekend in July, the 18th and 19th. So yeah, come on down. I'm also comparing, new word. Camp comparing. I'm comparing the Brighton Pride literature tent, can't say that word, literature tent this year, as well as reading for my new novel there. So come down and say hi at Brighton Pride 2. I'll be introducing a host of great authors and reading from This London Love. And that takes place on August the 1st. And lastly, like I said, we're going to be adding a new section to the show where authors can read out a slice of their work for you, the lovely listener. So if you fancy doing that or being interviewed on the podcast, drop me a line. I'm very approachable. I'm on at Claire Lydon at Twitter, or yeah, just drop me a mail, clairelydon@gmail.com. Anyway, enough about me. Let's get to the interview with Eliza Lenski. So, hello and welcome to the Lesbian Book Club. And joining me today is yet another super prolific author. I just keep finding them all over the world. Wisconsin-based Eliza Lenski has so far released a smorgasbord of lesbian romance, drama and erotica. Most recently, the third in her Winter Jacket series, Finding Home, which hit the top spot in the US lesbian romance charts. She was also the hugely popular author of the hugely popular 2014 novel Don't Call Me Hero, which dealt with PTSD in vets and coming to life, terms of life after war. So welcome to the show, Eliza.
Thank you very much, Claire.
It is fantastic to have you. And you're joining us today from your home in Wisconsin. Is there anything else you want to add to that intro, or did I just about cover it?
No, that sounds perfect. Makes me sound a lot more impressive than I think I actually am.
Well, you know, you have done quite a lot, so I think you should be very impressed with yourself. We're just coming off the Memorial Day weekend. So, did you do anything cool to celebrate that?
Lots of time with friends, lots of barbecues, drank too much beer.
Was that all at your house or other people's houses?
That's a good Wisconsinite, but it was a beautiful weekend in the city, so it was awfully nice.
Awesome. And as you say, you're talking to us from your home in Wisconsin. Now, I live in London, and I've no idea what Wisconsin is like. So can you describe your area for us, whereabouts you are?
Yeah, it's always interesting to me what people think they know about Wisconsin, or really just the Midwest in general. Hear lots about how people in Wisconsin like to drink beer and eat a lot of cheese, and I wish that I could buck that stereotype, and I love both of those things. But I live in Milwaukee, which is a mid-sized city. It's a very beautiful city right on Lake Michigan.
Yeah.
I love the city. People make eye contact. They smile a lot. They're very fiercely proud of living in this place.
Okay. And why cheese? I didn't know this cheese connection.
Oh, you didn't.
No.
There's lots of cows in Wisconsin, lots of farms. It's kind of the dairy capital of the world, always fighting with California for that that distinction.
Right. Yeah. Okay. There you go. See, I'm learning something today already.
Cheese, Wisconsin.
Yeah, clearly. Cheese and beer. I should come. It sounds like my kind of place. So let's talk a bit about your writing, as that's what we're here for. You started your writing career in fan fiction. So how did you get into that, and what kind of year was that, and what were you writing about?
I was in graduate school, living in Chicago at the time. This is probably 2005, 2006, I believe. And honestly, I had no idea that fan fiction existed. I didn't know this was a thing that people wrote, people read. I had never heard of things like shipping or fandoms. Mm-hmm. I kind of thought that I was the only person that was doing this thing, kind of naive of myself. But my favorite television show of all time, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, had gone off the air for about 2 years. So in its absence, I started writing my own stories about the series, mainly about Buffy and Faith. And I can't even really recall how I stumbled onto fandom archives, just a random Google search, I suppose. But eventually I found a really lovely group of women at a now-defunct Buffy archive, and they were some really talented writers there that really inspired and encouraged me. So that was kind of the root of where I am today.
Okay, and so how long were you doing the fan fiction for?
Probably about a decade. And I still do write, less now, more so than I did in the beginning. But it was quite a while.
Yeah, right. And so do you build up quite a following from that?
Mm-hmm. And really, I think that has been a credit to my modest success. I was really fortunate that when I did make that eventual leap from fan fiction to original stories, is that the people who really enjoyed the things I had written before, specifically for Buffy, had followed me then to original novels.
Mm-hmm. So did you turn in any of those kind of Buffy stories? Did you sort of massage them into the novels that you've now released?
The very first one, Date Night, was originally a Buffy and Faith story, but changed the names and the cities and the occupations and took out the demons and everything like that. All the supernatural things, but that had been kind of my first that segue then into the world of original novels.
Okay. And so when did you make the leap from fan fiction to published author, and how did you find that?
It's really kind of a relatively new venture for myself, 2002, 2013, something like that. And actually, I had submitted Date Night to a, after I'd made all of the changes and things, made, to a proper lesbian press, but it got rejected. So I, and really self-publishing was just starting to become more mainstream, usually because of the popularity of Fifty Shades of Grey, for better or for worse. So rather than resubmit the novel elsewhere, then I decided just to self-publish and, and do it on my own.
And how did that go, your first time out?
Everything was really, it was very, very modest success at first. I get excited about a few book sales, obsessively watch as the book slowly crept up the Amazon bestseller list. And so the first two books were kind of slow moving. And then seemingly overnight, I wrote this thing called Winter Jacket, and it exploded in popularity, and it's kind of been like that ever since.
Yeah, no, I mean, that series is going from strength to strength, and certainly right now in the charts as well. So tell me about sort of the inspiration for writing Winter Jacket. Tell me a bit about what it's about, and how did you start writing it? Was it, did you write the first one and then give it a break for a bit, or how did you keep everything in your head? Because it's been going for 2 years now, right?
Right, since 2013. Well, when I first wrote Winter Jacket, I had no plan that it was going to turn into a series. It was my third full-length novel at the time, and I simply wrote it just with the intention of writing a love story with a happy ending. And I've been inspired by so many Hollywood teacher-student romances that just always seem to go so poorly for the teacher specifically. And it really just boggled me. Why couldn't these women, these adult consenting women, have a happy ending? So I wrote Winter Jacket with the sole purpose of saying, I'm going to give these women the happy ending that they deserve.
And we're all for happy endings here.
No, exactly. So after I wrote Winter Jacket, the original, then I wrote Apophis, Love Story for the End of the World, and that was well received, but readers just kept asking for more Hunter and Elle, so I obliged with the second book, and it just kind of happenstance came out then in May of 2014. Then probably about halfway through writing book two, I realized that I had a lot more story to tell. So that's why if you read book two, it has more of a to-be-continued type of ending, more so than the tidier ending that happens in book one. Okay. And book three most recently has that similar to-be-continued ending.
Okay. So can we expect book four? Because I was looking at your reviews, and fans are clamoring for it, aren't they?
Yeah, and there definitely will be a book four, but readers should not expect to see that until May of 2016. All the Winter Jacket books have come out in the month of May, and maybe I'm a little OCD, but there's something I really like about that symmetry.
Yeah.
And I also kind of like the idea of having a four-book series. It's called Winter Jacket. There's four seasons, so why not make it four books, too? But I have no idea what's going to happen in book four. I've only really started to loosely plot it out. So I think depending on what I write on the final pages will determine if there's a book five. Because ultimately, I don't want to jump the shark. I don't want Elle and Hunter to wear out their welcome with readers. I think it's better to leave readers wanting more rather than have them become tired or bored with the story.
No, absolutely. And is it going to be, I guess you say you don't really know what's going on, because the third one's got a lot of angst in it, doesn't it? So
Certainly, yeah. And that was really nerve-wracking for me, because as I said, books one and two was all just about having a happy ending, but I think as I've grown as a writer, I've gotten a lot more confident. I'm able to take some risks that maybe I wasn't able to do in the first couple of years of this writing thing that I've been doing. So book three, certainly, I tell readers, you can't have a rainbow, you can't have sunshine, you can't really appreciate it without a little rain, and book three definitely it pours.
So they might get a little bit more sunshine in book four, maybe. And I was interested about the May release date you were saying. I quite like the, I agree with you, I'm a fan of symmetry, so I like that. But I was also, I'm sort of looking to release my third book, and I was looking into sort of romance books and when's the best time to release them, and apparently it is between February and May. So there you go. You just slotted into that, and I've just missed it. So, you know.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh dear. And talking about the characters of Hunter and Elle, have they been easy to develop and flesh out? And how have you kept it all in your head over the past 2 years? Is that easy to do?
No, it's not. it would be lying to say that this has been the easiest venture I've done. I think it's a lot easier to keep plot lines and character development and all of those things that make a compelling story in a 250-page novel and just a standalone. You only have to worry about what happens from point A to point B.
Yeah.
But when you have a series, that certainly has been, I would say, one of the biggest challenges in writing a series has been able to continue that development over several books.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think I took a risk in this third book with the characters, with their relationship. I was really nervous as I was writing this because readers are obviously very invested in what happens to these women. So I think there's a certain amount of pressure that not to mishandle these characters that they've really connected with. And I didn't know how readers would respond to the third novel if I'd ruined everything. Again, as I've become more comfortable, confident as a writer, I think I've taken a lot more risks with storylines. And I think that's really visible in the last couple of releases that I've had, too, that they're more than just sunshine and rainbows.
Yeah, more real life. Mm-hmm. And do you get readers, and you said that readers are quite invested in the characters, do you get people writing in sort of telling you what they'd like to happen to the characters?
Oh, I get all the time that they want them to get married and have babies and live happily ever after.
And you're like, I've just killed one of them. No, not really.
it's really very flattering. And obviously, it's been some great fun to have readers be so invested and to give me their ideas about what they think should happen and if Hunter and Elle should even be together still. And maybe there's another secondary character that they would be a better match. But all of that is a lot of fun. But largely, I ignore all of those things.
And you've got some unusual names in your books. Mm-hmm. Hunter's not one I come across, although I know it's been used in a few other lesfic novels, but still, so I think for British, it's not a name we come across. And Troy and how, when you're writing your books, do you keep names kicking around to use, or is it a challenge coming up with new ones?
I have a lot of difficulty actually coming up with names. I can write pages and pages and pages without stop, but when it comes to things like book titles and names of characters, that I get stuck. So I don't have a master list of names hanging up on my office wall. It's very organic in the moment when I'm writing the book. And sometimes I won't even give a character a name until moments before I'm ready to publish. I'll give them a placeholder name until the perfect name kind of comes to me. That happened with Cassidy Miller, actually, in Don't Call Me Hero.
Okay.
I can't even recall what I called her before, but it wasn't Cassidy before.
Okay, that's interesting. Character A.
Yeah. Main character, love interest, you know, all of that are just placeholders until, I don't know, lightning strikes and I feel inspired by a particular name.
Yeah. And what about Winter Jacket? Because I quite like that name. Did you come up with that quite early on in the process or later?
Yeah, that was one of those ones that it was a pretty obvious one to me because Hunter in the prologue to the first book, the reason why she catches Elle's eye is because she won't take off her winter jacket in the classroom, even though it's swelteringly hot in their class, and she just sits there with this long puffy jacket on, and they call her, she and Troyan, Elle's best friend, call her Winter Jacket in lieu of her proper name throughout the first couple of chapters.
Mm-hmm. Right, cool. And also, as well as romance, you've written some erotica as well. And how do you find writing sex scenes? Have they featured in every book you've written thus far?
I'm kind of blushing right now. But sex scenes are actually really hard for me to write. I can write banter, I can write dialogue for days, but those are the scenes that take a lot of time, a lot of focus. And sometimes if I'm just not inspired, I'll just do in bold words, insert sex scene here. Back to it later. All of my books though have sex in them except for Drained, which is kind of funny. because Drained is about succubi and incubi, these mythical creatures whose literal life source is sex, but there's no sex in Drained.
Okay.
My mom is a big supporter of everything I do, but I haven't let her read any of my books yet because of the sex scenes. And so she keeps asking me, each new book that comes out, she says, can I read this book? Can I read this book? No.
So it's still a no. It's still a no. Yeah.
But ultimately, I hope that it's not the sex scenes that are the draw to my books, but rather the love story that's found in between those pages.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's the only way you can incorporate sex scenes, isn't it? It's got to be a natural part of the story. Mm-hmm. But I'm totally with you on the whole mum's not reading my book, because she hasn't read either of mine either. And she does keep asking if she can, and she keeps saying, is it a sexy book? Because I have read sexy books before. And I said, no, I don't want to know that.
Oh, I know. There's just some things you don't want your mom to do.
So, you know, and luckily she has no idea how to work a Kindle or download anything, so I'm pretty safe, I think. And tell me about the inspiration for Don't Call Me Hero, which was a huge hit at the end of last year. Did you expect that kind of reaction?
No. I'm so pleased and so honoured that it really did take off like that. I've been really trying to recreate the success that I had with the first Winter Jacket, but it was like catching lightning in a bottle. And as far as inspiration, I've always wanted to write a series, not a Winter Jacket type series, which was kind of a happy accident, but a detective novel series.
Okay.
And one of my favorite book series as a young reader was I call them the Alphabet Murder books, but by the author Sue Grafton. A is for Alibi, B is for Burglar, C is for Corpse, on and on and on. And
yep.
I really fell for them, I think probably around high school. And ever since, I just wanted to create a character like her, Kinsey Millhone, this very vulnerable yet strong heroine. But I needed a vehicle. I needed to create my own character for that to happen. And that's ultimately the Cassidy Miller, my ex-Marine police officer, kind of damaged goods, but still really, really compelling.
Yeah. And really, really hit home with readers. And what's the reaction been like from those in the services?
Luckily, really overwhelmingly positive, which was a huge relief. I come from a family of police officers, and I'm familiar with...
Oh, that helps then.
Yeah, so that part of the story really came naturally, and it was a lot of fun kind of remembering certain smells and sights and sounds growing up, just being in that kind of environment. But the military aspect was foreign to me, and I really wanted to get it right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of that comes from being a historian, being really obsessed with details. And so for all of my books, I do a lot of outside research, but especially those that are on topics outside of my wheelhouse. So for Don't Call Me Hero, I read a lot of nonfiction on the military in general, but then also on what it's like to be a woman in the Marines, as well as research on living with PTSD.
Yeah, okay. Did you speak to any ex-Marines at all, or was it all done via sort of nonfiction reading?
I did have the opportunity to do an oral history with some folks, which was really fantastic. And again, because I wanted to get this thing right, I didn't want to do a disservice in my... in my road to writing this novel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that kind of thing is very interesting in itself anyway, isn't it? So just getting that sort of stuff down. And you also write paranormal urban fantasy under the name of E.L. Blaisdell. So are there lesbian characters in that too?
Well, E.L. Blaisdell has one novel so far, Drained, which I co-wrote with my friend Nika Kurt. And that book has characters really... from one end of the sexuality spectrum to the other, but the two main characters, Riley and Morgan, are I would identify them as probably pansexual.
Okay. Right. And you see, so that was the one you said had no sex in it, wasn't it? The Drained.
Right,
yes.
Right.
Yes.
some tension. There's some angst. There's some are they going to, are they not going to moments, and a lot of interruptions, inconvenient interruptions, but nothing as explicit as in the other novels.
And are you planning to do more under that name?
Ideally, yeah, Nika and I would love to continue the Drain series. It's just a matter of finding the time when we're not working on other projects. There's, you know, unfortunately only so many hours in the day, so many books to write, so little time. But in addition to Drained, ideally someday I would like to do a vampire lesbian book under that name. It's terribly cliche, but I feel like it would be really a disservice to all those years that I was writing Buffy fan fiction if I didn't.
I agree. So I think it's there waiting for you to come along and write it. And you know, I think readers would love it as well, because it's a proven winner, isn't it? It's a proven winning formula. And you say, as you said, there are only so many hours in the day, but I was looking at your timeline and it seems to me you've really revved up your writing speed over the past few years. You've published 5 novels in the last 12 months. So did you have some of them written a bit already, or did you start them all from scratch in that time?
In the last year, everything has been from scratch.
Right, wow.
And I'm kind of been, now that you say those numbers up there, I'm kind of impressed myself. But,
there you go, you see.
I've got a queue of ideas on my hard drive, and when I figure out which novel I want to work on next, I kind of write a few pages for each of the titles, see which characters are speaking to me the loudest. And I always say that in order to figure out what I'm going to work on next, I have to fall in love. I have to fall in love with a new character, a new storyline, a new couple. Mm-hmm. And until that kind of happens, I flirt a little bit. I flirt with some new characters, some new stories, do that background research on a variety of topics, and wait for one of these characters to seduce me.
Okay.
Just beg to be written.
Yeah, I like that description a lot. And you were saying that you're a historian. You've got a PhD, haven't you, in history. So is writing, I'm guessing, it's a full-time gig now?
It's close. I would say it's a two-thirds gig right now. A lot of my day is taken up by, because I am an independent author, I don't have a proper publisher, so I'm in charge of everything having to do with my writing career. Social media, my website, I do my own book covers, my own copy editing, which is really nice. I love the control, I love having the final say in everything that I attach my name to, but ultimately, obviously, it takes a lot of time. Mm-hmm. But I do still use my doctorate. I freelance as a historian, doing research projects for places like museums and historical societies. And ultimately, one day I would love for writing to be that full-time gig, but right now I'm certainly satisfied. I'm certainly ecstatic that it plays such a huge part of my everyday life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's nice that you get to indulge your other passion as well.
Yeah.
And I just want to pick up a bit on that self-publishing thing, because you know, I'm an independent published author as well. But I've got like some friends. A friend of mine does my covers. Another friend does my copy editing. But you do all of that yourself.
I do. Right. The only thing I manage all of my own. My website, I made that myself. I've made all the covers. Mm-hmm. I do my own copy editing. All of that is me. The only thing that I kind of outsourced was my snazzy avatar on my on my media. One of my friends is a really talented illustrator, so he wrote that for, or drew okay. that for me, rather.
And is that sort of reflective of how you look?
Yeah, it is. I showed it to my parents, and they were kind of like, wow, your friend is really good.
Cool. And what do you think of the, since self-publishing and independent publishing has gotten more mainstream, we have had an explosion in lesbian fiction over the past few years. What do you think about that?
Oh, obviously it's fantastic. The more the merrier, I always say. And as you said, the e-reader's ability to self-publish have certainly helped with that, because there's only so many novels that the proper publishers can produce in a year. And I think the ability to do this thing on our own is empowering. It's really done, I think most importantly, some amazing things for queer visibility. I get a lot of emails and messages on social media from women who are closeted or who are struggling with their sexuality, and talk to me about how reading lesbian novels is sometimes the only respite that they get from in their day. So in some small way, I hope that my stories and others like it are able to give these women courage, or at least a momentary distraction from the the rest of their day.
Yeah, and it's always nice, as like you say, when you get messages from people saying that, and I'm sure you get a ton of them because you've got a lot of books out there, so that's really cool. You might have to take on a virtual assistant soon to handle all your incoming email. are you an avid reader of Lesfic? Have you been reading anything good lately?
You know, it's kind of tragic. I don't have a lot of free time to read these days. When I do, it's typically nonfiction for my history life or right. research for the next book. But yep. when I do read lesbian fiction, I tend to go towards pulp fiction classics from the 50s and 60s. I recently started a reread of Claire Morgan's The Price of Salt in preparation of the upcoming film Carol.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm planning to read that as well, because I've seen the trailer of the movie and it looks really good, so yeah.
Yeah, I was pretty excited. Again, you know, this idea that TV, I think, has gotten it right as far as lesbian and bisexual characters go, and even trans women, but I think Hollywood has a way to go, and hopefully Carol will be that smash hit, I think, that the community really needs.
Well, I think, yeah, I think it's coming on, and I think there's a lot more stuff coming out this year, isn't it? This year, and that, what with the new one with Ellen Page in it, and I can't remember. It's looking better. And when can we expect the next title from you, and what will that be?
Oh, the next one is going to be, it looks like it's going to be late summer, probably in August sometime, and it's called Bittersweet Homecoming, and this is a book that's been kind of bouncing around in my head for, honestly, about 5 years now, and it's going to be a straight-up romance story, the gist being about a woman returning to her hometown after about a decade's absence, but the reasons why she's returning are under less than ideal circumstances. And very much like Winter Jacket, it's a love story, and there's going to be angst, and there will hopefully be a happy ending. I feel like that's my purpose in life, is yeah. to all of the happy endings.
Inject the rainbows into life. Mm-hmm. There you go. And which words and phrases do you find you most overuse in your everyday life and in your writing as well? Are there anything?
Pencil skirt.
Pencil skirt, okay.
Pencil skirt, yeah. A reader called me out on it a while ago. I think it was when Don't Call Me Hero came out, because apparently all of my characters wear pencil skirts.
Right.
except for Nora and Sam in Apophis, because they're tromping through this apocalyptic frozen wasteland, so they're in snow pants.
Yeah, you know, pencil skirts would be impractical.
Pencil skirt might be a hindrance, but it seems I've got a thing for women in skirts.
and would that be correct?
Yeah, I think it's pretty true to life.
There you go. Pencil. See, I can honestly say I don't think that's a phrase I've ever written in any of my books, because pencil skirts don't really...
Pencil skirts don't
for you, huh? No. They don't come into my life. And when you're not writing, how do you relax?
I suppose I'm kind of your typical Midwestern girl. I drink too much beer. I run a lot to get rid of that beer.
And cheese.
Really bad lesbian movies. During football season, I yell at the Green Bay Packers on my TV. I think probably one of the most unexpected things when people hear that I have a PhD is they think I'm very cerebral, that I'm, you know, just kind of in my head, stuck all the time. But I love nothing more than sports. I just want to yell at my television all the time. Yep. And it goes from like the most obscure sports to you know, something more mainstream like football.
Right. Yeah, cool. Now, I'm a big sports fan as well, so, or a soccer fan, as you guys would say. So. Mm-hmm. And, are you going to be watching the Women's World Cup, Soccer World Cup?
Definitely, yeah. So excited. Always a big to-do in our house. My partner grew up playing soccer.
Okay.
And I didn't, because my hometown wasn't big enough to have soccer leagues, but big fan.
Yeah, I would have loved to have grown up playing soccer, but when I was at school, it was very much a boys, you know, very much a boys thing. So me and my friend were the first two girls to play in the boys team.
Oh, nice.
But then we were pushed into netball. Not the same as playing soccer, really, but there you go. Yeah. So no, but I'm really looking forward to it. And yeah, it should be great. So, and final question, if you could be the love child of any two writers, alive or dead, who would you choose?
A I really love this question, I have to admit.
My
writing parents, if I were the love child, would be Judy Blume and Jane Austen.
Oh, cool. I love that. Yeah.
And, you know, obviously, I think that, you know, the Brits are obviously familiar with Jane Austen. But do you guys know Judy Blume?
Yes. She was very big over here.
So I've always said that Judy Blume taught me everything that I know about me, being a girl, and Jane Austen taught me everything I needed to know about being a feminist. Actually, Judy Blume, she's got a new book out right now for adults, and she said in this interview was amazing. She was talking about how she doesn't think she's a very good writer, but that perhaps she's a pretty good storyteller, and I thought that was pretty profound. Because ultimately, that's what I aspire to be. I hear a lot, I read a lot in reviews that I'm a pretty quick read, an easy quick read. But that's my style. That's the way that I write. I don't try to be too flowery or complicated or esoteric. Mm-hmm. Instead, I just really want to tell compelling stories and create characters with whom readers hopefully find some common ground.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I love that quote as well, because I think the storytelling is what it's all about. And you can be a good writer, but if you're a great storyteller, then that makes it. So,
exactly. Yeah.
Cool. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure, Eliza. Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, thank you so much for taking the time. And what are you up to for the rest of the day?
Oh, I'm actually volunteering at a historical society.
Okay.
I do that often on my afternoons. I volunteer some time at museums and historical societies just to keep my my history degree working, I suppose.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, have a great rest of the day. And yeah, thank you so much again.
Thanks to you.
Okay, take care.
Well, that's the end of this Lesbian Book Club, so this is me, Claire Lydon, signing off. If you fancy finding out more about Eliza, you can find her at elizalensky.com or at elizalensky on Twitter. And if you fancy dipping into either of my books, London Calling or The Long Weekend, you can find out more at clairelydon.co.uk or look me up on Amazon, Kobo, iTunes or any of the other digital media outlets. I'm also on Twitter at Claire Lydon, so come on down and follow me there, and you can be thrilled daily with my witty tweets and all the rest. But now, join me next time for more Hot Book Club action, but for now, stay tuned. I'm going to read you the first chapter of my new book, This London Love, which is due out in June, so this month. Excitement. Anyway, here it is, This London Love, Chapter 1. Kate Carter picked up the bottle of Veuve Clicquot and refilled her glass. She pulled down the cuffs of her egg-white shirt, flexed her calf muscles under her black trousers, and waited for the laughter to die down. She'd been at her company's awards ceremony for over an hour now, and the woman hosting wasn't quite as funny as she thought she was. The team from Kate's magazine, Female Health and Fitness, were sitting at a round table at the centre of a function room in a swish Mayfair hotel, surrounded by at least 50 other tables, all filled with an endless supply of Bordeaux, Chablis and Champagne. It wasn't Christmas, but you might be forgiven for thinking otherwise, because the room was already bathing in anticipation and sparkle. Kate didn't do dresses, so she'd opted for a black tuxedo, the first time she'd ever done so. It sat well on her tall, slim frame. She should have done it years ago. She leaned back in her chair and rolled her ankle, the light catching on her black patent brogues. More dazzle. Kate! Kate! Her colleague Henry was not doing a good job of keeping his voice down. Kate! Psst! Kate, pass me the bottle! Henry held out his hand, his cheeks already alight with champagne splotch, his pupils periodically sparking then slumping. Kate could already tell that Henry's lovingly conditioned hipster beard was going to be hiding some food by the end of the night, and if he didn't lose his phone, as he did on most of these occasions, she'd eat her bow tie. But she passed him the bottle anyway. Kate wasn't a killjoy. On stage, music blared as the winner of Feature of the Year trotted up to collect her gong. Kate had seen the winner walking the corridors in their building, and she wasn't a fan. The woman never heard the door open if you were behind her, and Kate had witnessed her being rude to staff in the canteen on numerous occasions. Never trust people who are rude to serving staff, life lesson number one. True to form, the woman shook out a speech with almost as many words as her lemon dress had sparkles, and Kate let her eyelids flutter shut. She didn't mind these occasions, but the speeches could be a bit of a bore. Kate opened her eyes when she got an elbow in the ribs. Are we next? I thought they said we were in the first half. Her magazine editor, Dawn, was fidgeting with her red napkin. In recent years, Dawn had never come to one of these ceremonies and not won anything, so Kate hoped she wasn't let down today. The March issue of Female Health and Fitness magazine was up for cover of the year, and they all thought it stood a fighting chance. I think we might be next, Kate said. Do you think if we win, management will spring for us to go abroad for a week? Sun, sea, sangria, what do you think, all on them? Dawn spluttered. I'm sure it'd be no problem at all. Their conversation was interrupted as the winner on stage got a huge cheer for something she'd said. The woman waved at the crowd and grinned. And finally, thanks to my darling fiancé Hugo, oh, you're the best and I can't wait to marry you next year. To a cacophony of cheers and whistles, the previous winner tottered off the stage in heels the height of goalposts, and the next award flashed up on the screens, Cover of the Year. This is it! Dawn dug her fingers into Kate's arm in excitement. Kate watched as the company's art supremo, Simon, was called to the stage to present the winner. In all her years working as a designer, Kate had never won Cover of the Year. It was something she was desperate to remedy, even if she was trying to underplay it tonight. She bit her lip and ran her hands through her platinum blonde hair as Simon began to speak. It's true what they say. People judge a magazine by its cover. If the image, cover lines, and overall ethos don't appeal to them, they'll move on. The magazine market is a cutthroat, fickle business, so snagging customers is all important in the battle to stay alive. Dawn turned to Kate and gave her a best knowing nod, combining it with the raising of both eyebrows. On stage, Simon continued. All of these next five covers fulfilled that brief in terms of having a vibrant imagery, must-do cover lines, and engaging the reader. Let's take a look. Simon stood back in his Armani suit as the covers flashed up one after the other on the giant screen, receiving rounds of applause and whoops from the appropriate tables. When it was the turn of Female Health and Fitness, their table lit up, glasses clinking, whistling and applauding. A minute later, though, the screams had died down and the tension settled back on the room. On stage, the envelope was ripped, and Simon smiled, moving his mouth closer to the mic. And the winner is truly well-deserved and a personal favourite of mine. Well done to Female Health and Fitness magazine for its March cover. Kate's heart rate soared and her mouth dropped open. They'd only gone and done it. Dawn flung herself at Kate. I can't believe it, we bloody won! When Dawn released her, Kate looked around the table at her team, arm raised in the air, volume ratcheted to the max as they celebrated in unison. On stage, Simon was speaking into the mic. Come on up, art editor Kate Carter and editor Dawn West. Hearing her name called, Kate finished high-fiving her co-workers, but found her grin was stuck solid to her face. She shrugged on her jacket and straightened her bow tie, before taking Dawn's hand and pulling her up towards the stage. Dawn brushed imaginary crumbs from her sparkly blue dress as she followed Kate, tottering like a pro on her extra-large heels. "Have you prepared a speech?" she muttered in Kate's ear. Kate turned and shook her head. "Thought it might jinx it." They were at the stairs now, leading up to the stage, and Kate had goosebumps all over. "How's my hair?" she asked. "Gorgeous and ultra-lesbian." Dawn kissed Kate on the cheek. Tell you what, if you don't pull tonight in that tux and with this award in the bag, the world's gone barking mad. Dawn gave Kate a wink, then she was up the stairs, taking Kate with her. They reached the debonair Simon, who was holding the glass trophy in one hand. He went to give it to Dawn, but she shook her head and gently pushed Kate forward. Kate bashfully accepted the award from Simon, and he kissed her on both cheeks. Then he stood back and applauded while Dawn got on the mic. Thank you, you lovely people. Dawn had never been shy of public speaking, and she wasn't about to start being shy now. I'd like to say a massive thank you to my whole team, who are all brilliant, but mostly thanks to the brains behind this cover, my dear friend, Kate Carter. Dawn turned her clapping in Kate's direction before darting back to the mic. Oh, and even though he's not here, thanks to my husband Nick for being a saint and putting up with me. With that, Dawn backed away. Kate replaced Dawn at the mic and held the trophy aloft. The crowd applauded, and through the dim lighting she saw Henry and features editor Hannah clapping madly, arms above their head. Like Dawn said, this is a team effort, but thanks again for the award, it means a lot. Kate was shaking slightly, and she felt Dawn's soothing hand on her back. I'd like to thank my editor Dawn, my deputy art editor Henry, and everyone on the magazine. Thanks, this really does mean a lot. Kate felt the love in the room embrace her as she held the trophy aloft. But then it hit her as she looked out across the swathe of smiling people, most of whom had somebody to go home to celebrate with. For Kate, that was not the case. Sure, she had her editor and her team to toast with tonight, but there was no girlfriend or wife who she could dart back to the microphone and thank, as the previous two speakers had. Being single didn't ordinarily bother her, but at this moment she could feel it clogging her arteries and slowing her breathing. In this lifetime, right now, Kate was flying solo. But, ever the professional, she started out, never losing her grin, glossing over the fact she had nobody to say she loved as a footnote on such a grand night. Instead, she made an after-you gesture to Dawn, took her hand and held it aloft as they made their way back down the stairs and to their team, placing the trophy in the middle of the table as they both sat down. Incredible! I still can't believe we won! Dawn simply couldn't wipe the smile off of her face. I can. It was a brilliant cover, Henry said. Made all the more brilliant by my addition of gloss to the headline, didn't you think, Kate? Henry had on his serious face, which made Kate burst out laughing. It was all about you, Henry, she said, patting his shoulder. Pulling her chair up to the table and rubbing her hands together, Dawn smiled around at her team, the adrenaline clearly sparking in her veins. Right, now that's over with, let's have a great night. Nobody has to be in tomorrow till lunchtime at the earliest. She paused and pulled the champagne from the bucket, then frowned in Henry's direction when she saw it was empty. Dawn looked around and accosted a nearby waiter. Two more bottles when you're ready, please.